What you hear is that old time bomb still ticking the time away. But this week's good word of a program for controlling the atom and the good chance your letters to Washington have given us to keep that control away from the military give us the right, I think, to turn off our little sound effect a little earlier than usual this bright Sunday morning. Orson Welles speaking, bringing you 15 minutes worth of one man's opinion. I don't make a specialty of rumors, but I hear from Washington that Secretary of State Jimmy Burns is back in the good graces of Admiral Leahy and company. It's no secret the boys were after his scalp, and I happen to know that General Marshall was up for the job. Incidentally, Marshall is definitely coming back from China right away. Since Mr. Burns broke half the rules of parliamentary procedure in Hunter College last week, running the UNO meeting at times like the ringmaster of a circus, the Get Tough with Russia gang have decided they want him to stay right where he is. Mr. Burns is presently being described as a great statesman, but the formula he's being praised for was something Mr. Hodgson of Australia wanted to present earlier, but the motion wasn't put, so Mr. Hodgson doesn't get the credit for being a statesman. Mr. Burns didn't give them the chance. When Gromyko took his walk, he was only refusing to talk about Iran before April 10th. The good news, for what it's worth, is that Russia did not apply the veto to discussion. Note, up to here, Britain and America put a kind of veto on discussion of another matter, the tyranny in Franco-Spain. Poland breaks the silence now. We shall see what we shall see. Well, we had Gromyko's word for it that the Iranian question wasn't a question at all, and I don't think it was much of a question at that. Burns insisted on the right of Iran to come before the council and have its say. Gromyko wanted the subject postponed, claimed it wasn't fit to discuss anyway. Looks like Gromyko was right about that, but the principle is wrong that it's up to a big power to decide whether a small nation has a case against it or not. If UNO is going to make any moral sense at all, then of course its members must all have the chance to air their complaints, real or fancied or trumped up. Gromyko asked for a short delay, a perfectly fair request. If he'd shown reasons for it, he couldn't or didn't choose to offer such reasons, and that was the main weakness of his argument. Oil. None of the delegates have been heard to speak the nasty word, but as I've said here before and here all along, oil is the core of the crisis. Russia wants transit rights to the Persian Gulf. Russia wants to secure her borders with the buffer state of Azerbaijan, but what Russia wants most from Iran isn't friendship or a way to the sea. Russia wants oil. Russia has oil of her own, plenty of oil. Plenty for peace, but not enough for war. That sounds pretty grim, and it is. Russia wants oil for war. You can't laugh that one off. But you can jump to conclusions, the wrong conclusions. Because Russia wants oil for war, it does not follow that Russia wants war. No, Russia wants peace as much as we do, if possible, even more. But according to communist doctrine, capitalist powers can't keep the peace. We don't want war, but we don't trust Russia. These international arguments start and finish with that mutual suspicion. Everybody wants peace, and nobody believes in it. The man who died a year ago next Friday once told us that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. We're learning a bitter lesson, as it was here at home, so it is among the nations. Fear is something to be afraid of. When you listeners have written me on almost every subject in the world, I've had letters of complaint and encouragement by the thousands, questions and suggestions, anecdotes and editorials, and for some time now I've made it a practice to put at least one of your letters on the air each week. A maker of fine radios has given me the chance to repay you for your trouble by sending you a radio for the letters I use. Lately I've fallen a little in arrear, so today we'll have two letters and catch up. The first is from Seattle, Washington. Dear Mr. Welles, I'd like to entitle this The Death of a Liberal, or something dramatic like that, but actually isn't that bad. However, I do find myself, along with a lot of other young people, being pushed from the left, politically speaking, to the right. This is known in polite circles as growing up or adjusting to things as they are. I happen to dislike things the way they are. I think too many people get a raw deal. I don't like to read about Negroes who were turned away from state universities or made to sit in the rear of buses. I don't like to hear about the worker who tries to support her five children on a take-home pay of $15.80 a week and is considered greedy for asking for more. I find that I'm in favor of racial equality and a higher standard of living for everyone. Is there anything radical about that? If you don't think so, Mr. Wells, drop in on the local matrons at the next tea when I happen to say a good word for unions or fair employment legislation, and I fear it's much worse at the businessmen's lunch meeting. It seems that the older and supposedly wiser generation is shocked by every progressive idea that is advanced. If we're going to get along with them and make desirable social contacts, we shall either have to muzzle ourselves or become staunch defenders of the status quo. At times it appears there's no choice. Yours very truly, Beth F. Carter. Dear Miss Carter, I know just how you feel. All of us on the progressive side of the argument get discouraged sometimes. Sure, it's easier to drift with the wind, let things go as they are, to keep the friendship and esteem of all the cautious-minded folk, and to leave the hard work of reform to the other fellow. It's much easier to stay neutral in the war between injustice and democracy. Nobody at the matron's tea or the businessman's luncheon table blames you for not voting. Does look as though you can't get hurt if you stay out of the fight. But the truth is, you can't stay out of the fight. You don't want to, or you wouldn't have written me as you did. Anyway, it isn't a matter of choice. Whether they know it or not, everybody's in this fight. And the more you try to stay out of it, the better your chances are of getting hurt. The old battle between evil and good is still raging, and there's no such thing as a non-combatant. Of course, it's always easy to give advice. It's easy for me to tell you to stay in the fight, but believe me, Miss Beth Carter, I am not speaking from any special fortress of personal safety. I don't get to speak out on these questions for free. Free speech costs money, costs me a lot of money. I'm very grateful for the opportunity I've been given in the press and on the radio to speak my mind. I make no complaint of the fact that speaking my mind has brought me often real financial embarrassment. You know, many radio programs I used to work on have ceased to hire me since I've been using the radio so outspokenly. I've been trying, for instance, to sell the Mercury Theater for a limited series of broadcasts reviving our best shows of other years. And since your obedient servant has become one of those things known as a controversial figure, the Mercury has had to put its price down to go on the market at all. Last week, we thought we had a sponsor, but at the last moment, he started worrying about how controversial I am and the project collapsed. Now, I'm being very frank only to show you that you're not alone. I'm not asking you to think of me as some kind of martyred hero. I'm no hero at all. I'm far from being martyred. I'm one of the luckiest and most overpaid men in the world. I'd just like you to see that I really do appreciate your problem. You are very young, Miss Carter, and I am not as young as I was, so I have a right to tell you that wanting to change the world is not a sickness of youth. On the contrary, not wanting to change the world is the sickness of age. The world is always changing for better or for worse. The world is always moving, but if we left all the moving to the old folks, we'd move only backwards. I happen, you say, to dislike things the way they are. Good for you. You'll be called a crank and a malcontent, but really, you're a lover of life. The lover of life always hates things as they are. That's part of the celebration of that love. The celebration itself is the occupation of youth. To participate is the sign of youth. I've known men and women with almost a century of years behind them who are participants. It's the old who fear death, the old in spirit. And it's only these who like things as they are. They'll settle for any kind of world just so they can stay in it. That's what it means to be a Tory. To be a Tory is to be old. To be a Tory is to fear death so much that you prefer mere survival to life itself. No, Miss Carter, don't let him kid you. Adjusting to things as they are is not maturity, it is collaboration. Giving up is not growing up. If we are to make desirable social contacts, you say, we shall either have to muzzle ourselves or become staunch defenders of the status quo. Miss Carter, what, if you please, is a desirable social contact? You'll have to decide what company you want to keep. Do you want to be friends with the living or the dead? You can't have it both ways. It's true enough, of course, that those in decay can be very dear to our hearts. It's not a happy choice, I know. Some of my best friends are corpses. When you bring up the Negro question, Miss Carter, and this brings me to another letter, a letter from a citizen called Earl Snyder. Mr. Sidner wrote for a magazine. I wrote a column for the newspapers about Mr. Sidner's article. And in order to explain this, I'll have to quote from my column first of all. It goes like this. Maybe we shouldn't mention a certain piece in a periodical called The American Home, but we're going to. It's a run-of-the-mill layout. quote, they put the difference into war bonds, unquote, reads the caption. It's been done and done, you know, by a dozen similar magazines. Just pictures of newlyweds in their bright little home. The pose is perfectly traditional. But the young wife and her husband are Negroes. This is announced only by the fact of the photographs. The text is about how to save money by building your own furniture. That's all. Had this been a discussion of Negro housing, had it suggested, however elliptically, that Negroes do not necessarily keep their coal in the bathtub, the article would have been guilty of that error the well-intentioned majority tends to make in its relationships with the minority peoples. We look forward to the day when such items as the one we've called attention to are the rule, not the exception, and when such columns as this will be superfluous. Until then, we submit that the American Home magazine should be very proud of its May issue. That's as far as my column went on the subject, and now comes Mr. Sidney's letter. Dear Mr. Wells, he writes, in a newspaper column, you complimented the American Home magazine for publishing an article with pictures of a couple in their bright little home without once mentioning the caption or context, except for the pictures that the couple were Negroes. Well, we were very pleased with your comment, Mr. Wells, for I was the author, and those pictures were of my wife, Virginia, and me. A neighbor of ours had sent us your clipping in a letter to California, where I was then stationed, and Virginia was visiting me there at the time. Then I read our neighbor's letter. I began to wonder. I wondered if my article should not have been on Negro housing. Wondered if I'd not missed an opportunity to tell them that the American home therein pictured was not only a show of resourcefulness in the face of wartime shortages and high prices, but a victory over the slums. Mr. Wells, have you ever seen the slums stalk a house, a neighborhood, or even a whole side of town? All around the slums, with its cold, damp, musty earth smell, sits like a death watch, poking a finger through the plaster here, a rat hole there, getting a foothold in the loose bricks, ready to move in. And once in, there's no dispossessing. The kids of the neighborhood seem to know when a house has been conquered by the slums long before the city fathers reluctantly condemn it for further human inhabitants. At last, the last family has moved out to double up with a relative or a friend, and then the kids from the block take over. They seem to want to punish the old house for having given up the struggle, so they break the remaining windows. They race through the dark, deserted halls playing cops and robbers. They corner their quarry in a room. And though the door is still there on one hinge, they prefer to break through the crumbling walls and bring out their man dead or alive, just like the movies. They make their fun for this in the streets of the playground for the children of the slums, and this is the breeder of crime, and this is the breeder of disease. Finally, one of the kids breaks a leg in the old house, and the roof falls in, and then the city fathers come and seal up the door and broken windows. Now there's one less place to play, and one less house for the families of the ghetto. Mr. Wells, we live in that Harlem ghetto where substandard houses, overcrowded conditions, and sky-high rents are the order of the day. There is one single block in Harlem in which 3,871 people live. A similar density for all the United States population would result in the whole of America's population living in one half of New York City. This is the ghetto, Mr. Wells, and the wall is all around us, high with covenants and unwritten codes of restrictions. In that American Home article, I was a husband of limited means with a new wife, and I wanted to share my solution to the furniture problem with other husbands in the same plight. So for a moment, I indulged in the luxury of just being an American. But that letter from my neighbor focused the picture into painful sharpness. Dear Earl and Virginia, it read, the roof over your apartment is leaking again this year. The rain must be pouring in through in torrents, for even as far as two floors directly below you, the plaster is falling from the walls as a result. So send me the keys to your apartment. I'll look in and advise you of the damage done your little place so beautifully pictured in this month's issue of the American Home. Yours very truly, Earl Sidney. Mr. Sidney and Miss Carter get a radio with my thanks. And my thanks to you for listening. Please let me come to call the same time next week. Until then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.